Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Oliver D. Crisp, professor of systematic theology at Fuller Theological Seminary in Pasadena, California. As Waylon Jennings would say, Professor Crisp is a rambling man, having also taught at the University of St. Andrews, the University of Bristol, and Regent College just up the road from me in British Columbia, as well as having done postdoc fellowships at Notre Dame and Princeton, neither of which are in British Columbia. Among his many interests, Oliver specializes in the study of systematic theology, historical theology, hamartiology, Christology, soteriology, the theology of Jonathan Edwards' eology, and Reform theology. If that isn't enough to keep him busy, he has authored 8 monographs, including Divinity and Humanity, The Incarnation Reconsidered, Revisioning Christology, Theology in the Reformed Tradition, Jonathan Edwards on God and Creation, and most recently, Deviant Calvinism, Broadening Reformed Theology. The latter book will be the topic of our discussion today. Now, I could go on and on with more of his accomplishments and note that he is about 10 years younger than I am, but this would only make me feel academically inadequate. Thus, I will tell all of you to look up his full biography and list of accomplishments at the link we will provide at our website. Oliver, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Ooh, and he has an accent, too. It's a British accent. You're a British guy.
I am an Englishman, actually, originally from London many years ago. So although I spent quite a few years of my adult life in Scotland, the accent didn't rub off, and I'm unfortunately stuck with my English accent.
Oh, stuck with it. Well, yeah, when I first read your biography and I saw St. Andrews, I thought that you were Scottish. And,
yeah. Well, I wish I was in some ways, but at least I'm English. It's maybe the next best thing, I think.
It is good. The accent always makes you sound good. So that is, for some reason, us folks in America, we just think British people sound really smart because they got that accent. And it's not only that accent that makes you sound really smart, but it's all of these eologies that you're dealing with. I have to ask, what is... And I'm probably pronouncing this one wrong, so correct me here. What is hamartiology? It sounds like the study of painting pictures of pigs with
ham and art. Yeah, study of hams or something like that.
Yeah.
Well, it's actually to do with the study of human sin from the Greek word hamartia, which is one of the words used for sin in the New Testament, falling short of the mark. So that's what it's about. It's just a fancy word for the study of human sinfulness, basically. So a cheerful thing to spend my time doing, but there we go.
Yeah, they should call it something easier to pronounce, such as studying sinology or something. I could pronounce that. What about this other one? And this keeps coming up, and people have to remind me of it. Soteriology, what is that?
Yeah, so that also has got a sort of ancient language. It basically means the study of salvation. Soteria, having to do with... the notion of salvation. So, that's what that's about. Hamartiology is to do with sin, and soteriology is to do with salvation. I prefer the latter to the former, to be honest with you, but at least if you start with the latter, you can get to the former. At least if you start with the former, you can get to the latter, that is. If you start with sin, hopefully you'll end up talking about salvation, which is what I prefer to spend my time doing.
Yeah, and it sounds like it's two parts of the same sandwich. So
right, exactly. No, yeah. I think that's a good way of putting it.
Yeah, makes sense that you'd be studying those together. And speaking of all this, speaking of sin and speaking of salvation, we want to be talking about Calvinism today and your new book, Deviant Calvinism, great title, by the way, has this nice little book blurb on the back cover. And it says, quote, "Deviant Calvinism seeks to show that the Reformed tradition is much broader and more variegated than is often thought." Now, I have to agree with that book blurb because, first, I will admit to not knowing much about Reformed theology, which is why I'm having you on the show today. I need to learn about this. And second, whenever I hear anybody claim to adhere to Reformed theology, I immediately think, ugh, this person is not going to be fun to hang around with. So I want you to help set me straight on all of this and fill in some of my blind spots on historical theology, because that is what you do. How about if we start with some basics, going all the way back to the early 16th century, and explain who this guy that was named after Calvinism, John Calvin, is?
Sure. Yeah, I can say a little bit about that. Well, John Calvin was originally from France, northern France, Picardy, and he was born at the beginning of the 16th century, so a long time ago. And he was schooled in France, went to university in France, and during his university studies became convinced of the evangelical cause, as it was called then, and ended up leaving France, and through a sort of long journey, finally winding up in Geneva, which is the place that made him famous. And he spent some time in Geneva. He got kicked out, actually, from Geneva. They didn't like his reforming ways, but then he eventually came back triumphantly and carried on his reforming project there. And in addition to being involved in reforming the city of Geneva in Switzerland, he was also someone who wrote voluminously, seemed to always have a pen in his hand, and wrote commentaries on nearly all the books of the Bible, as well as writing a great sort of summary of Christian doctrine for which he is best known, which was called his Institutes of the Christian Religion, which he revised periodically throughout his life. So he started off a short version at the beginning of his career, and by the end of his career, the final version of that, which was published in 1559, is two volumes in English translation, so it's a significant piece of work. So he's an important person because of his personal influence in the period of the Reformation, and also because of the influence he's had through his writings, which continue to be read right up to this day, in fact.
Now, you mentioned that he went to Geneva and was involved in reforming Geneva.
Yeah.
What does that mean? I mean, it sounds like this guy's writing a lot, but is he out there pastoring? Is he out there in the town square telling everybody to repent and stop buying into all this indulgence stuff?
Well, he certainly was involved in pastoring to some extent. He preached on a weekly basis in the church there in Geneva. He was involved in sort of politics, in a sense, because he was involved with the various aspects of the councils and consistory and so on that formed the political life of the city. And through that was an influence on getting the way the city was run changed so that it was more in keeping with Reformation principles rather than sort of late medieval principles. So I think his personal influence was considerable, really. I mean, it was both, there's a kind of political dimension, although sometimes that's overstated. You know, people think of Calvin as the dictator of Geneva, but he never really was. He never had that power. But he certainly had ecclesiastical influence and was regularly preaching the gospel in the churches. So his whole life was really devoted to those sorts of activities, and somehow he managed to find the time to write as much as he did, which is kind of amazing on top of everything else.
Yeah, it is. Well, you're writing that much. I'm not writing that much. He probably had the benefit of not having NFL Sunday Ticket back then, so
right.
That takes at least a day away from me. But did he grow up in Catholic seminary?
Well, he certainly grew up as a Roman Catholic, as we'd understand it today, in France, and he looked like he was in some sort of minor orders, clerical orders, in the early part of his life. But he had this break during the end of his student days from the religion that he grew up with. He got involved with the sort of reforming influences in France, and it was largely as a result of that he had to leave the country in fear of his life. He did start out that way in France, but the more he was involved in the reforming movement, the more he became convinced of it, and eventually that led him to Geneva. The interesting thing about Calvin, actually, is although he writes so much and is such an important figure, we have very little from his own pen describing his own life and his own changes, religious changes over time. There's very little that's actually written by him of a kind of autobiographical nature. So that's been a bit of a conundrum for historians looking back and trying to figure out, you know, at what point did Calvin change his views? When did he become a reformer? When did he become a Protestant? It's a tricky thing to try and sort out when someone unlike Luther isn't spending half his time telling you what's going on in his own heart and mind. Yeah. Calvin seems to have been a bit reserved in that regard.
There is some overlap between Luther and Calvin. I think it's, you know, they were born, I would guess, about 20 or so years apart. And so there's that overlap in terms of them. Am I correct in that?
Yeah, that's right. I think Luther's born in about 1483. Calvin's born in about 1509. So they're about a generation, nearly a generation apart.
So Calvin is picking up the vibes from the Protestant Reformation, from what Luther did. What is interesting to me is that Luther seems to get more top billing in all of this Protestant Reformation bit. I mean, he nails up a list of 95 things on a church door,
right,
and he gets his own special Reformation Day, but Calvin doesn't seem to have any of that. Is that because Luther is much more of a personality for us as compared to Calvin?
I think that's part of it, yeah, definitely. I mean, I think also Luther's the one who starts the ball rolling without getting burnt at the stake or beheaded or something like that, as some previous reformers had done.
Yeah, Jan Hus doesn't have a day.
People like Hus, for example, had a bit of a harder time.
Yeah.
So he's important in that regard. I think also with Luther, you're right, he's very much more of a personality than Calvin is. We have all Luther's table talk, and so there's records of the various things he said in his household with people who were constantly passing through and staying there. He was a great lover of things like beer and so on. So he was quite a convivial and larger-than-life character in a way that, in a sense, Calvin wasn't. But I think more important perhaps than either of those things is the fact that although both wrote a great deal and although both had a great deal of influence in the shaping of two different streams of the Protestant Reformation, the stream of the Reformation that originates with Luther becomes directly associated with Luther's name and is now today known as Lutheranism, and a lot of Luther's work feeds into that, and people in that tradition look to Luther as a kind of fountainhead. The same isn't true of the Reformed tradition. Although Calvin is important in the Reformed tradition, he's only one of a number of different major leaders of that tradition, and the Reformed tradition doesn't look to Calvin as its fountain origin in quite the same way as Lutheranism does, I think. So that's also a way in which they're different.
Hmm. That is very interesting, because when you think back on this too, the Reformed theology really is reverberating, I think, much more through our current Christianity today than Luther's thoughts are, if I could qualify that or could say that. Which is very interesting, and that's one of the things that we're going to be talking about today, because we hear quite a bit about Reformed theology, and we need to figure out what this is. But speaking of Calvin and his theology at the time in the first half of the 17th century there, or I should say 16th century, what were some of the distinct themes in his theology that brought him to prominence?
Well, I mean, I think all the reformers, the magisterial reformers as this, which are the reformers who were involved with kind of the reform of a particular state or city, have a great emphasis on divine sovereignty. That's true of Luther as much as it is of Calvin in some ways. But there are several sorts of themes that, although you can find them elsewhere in the Christian church, they're not necessarily unique to the Reformed tradition, nevertheless have become a particular preserve of the Reformed tradition, if you like. And some of those are certainly present in Calvin's work. I mean, I think that the absolute divine sovereignty of God and the glory of God and the fact that God has created us to reflect his glory and to have relationship with him, for us to be united with him in Christ, that's an important theme in Calvin's work. Also, in Calvin's work, you get this sense that human beings are really morally corrupt as a result of the fall from grace in the primeval garden, so that we are incapable of doing anything to bring about our own salvation. We are entirely dependent on God's grace to do that. And I think alongside that, there's a view of what Christ's work is all about and the incarnation is all about, that Christ is standing in our place as a kind of substitute for us, and that his work is a redemptive one that brings about our salvation in virtue of him somehow satisfying divine justice and things like that. Calvin has some other interesting views that not all other Reformed thinkers have. So, for example, he's got, I think, really interesting views about things like the difference between revelation in nature and revelation in Scripture. And he thinks that, you know, God's revealing himself in Scripture, as it were, but we just don't have the equipment to pick up the signals, a bit like a broken transistor radio, because of our moral corruption through sin. And so God's got to heal us by the power of the Holy Spirit, a bit like fixing the transistor radio, for us to pick up, as it were, the radio waves that God is communicating in the world around us, so that many people can look at the world around them and not immediately form a view there is a God. However, once our hearts and minds are renewed by the power of the Spirit, then we do suddenly see that the world around us speaks of the glory of God in all his myriad ways, so that the natural order tells us something important about who God is, just as the Bible does as well. So those are just some of the things that Calvin has to say. I mean, people zero in on Calvin's doctrine of election, the idea that we're predestined and that God has ordained all things from the foundation of the world. And certainly that is an important feature of his thought, but it's not right up at the front of his Institutes of the Christian Religion. It appears much later in the Institutes of the Christian Religion. And these other themes are also important themes in his work, alongside the doctrine of sort of absolute predestination, the idea that God predestined us to salvation or to damnation before the foundation of the world.
And I'm having a feeling that this is going to play a central role in some of the work that you do on deviant Calvinism and the Reformed tradition, because you think some things are a little bit overemphasized and some things are neglected.
That's true to some extent. I mean, I think that my work in deviant Calvinism is about trying to get contemporary readers and aficionados of Reformed theology to see again that there's much more breadth to the Reformed tradition than sometimes we're led to believe these days. Not all of that is due to Calvin. As I said earlier, there are a number of different leaders in the Reformed tradition, but nevertheless, I think that there's more breadth, there's a richness, there's a depth to the tradition that it's useful to explore, and I think my book is trying to recommend that in many ways. I have to say, though, that it's very much dependent on the excellent work that other people have done before me. It's hardly fair to say that I'm recommending a broader, deeper, richer account of the Reformed tradition and I'm the first person to have done it. Quite the reverse, in fact. In many ways, I'm simply standing on the shoulders of the giants, if you like. I'm building on the work of a number of different historical theologians in particular, who in the last generation have helped us to see that this is true of the Reformed tradition, that it is broader, richer, and deeper than perhaps sometimes gets reported in the popular press.
Well, that might be true, but those other theologians have not been on Research on Religion, and you have. So that's what's really important. That's what it comes down to. I want to spend just a few more minutes on Calvin and see how his thought and his work has been translated throughout the centuries, because, again, as I mentioned early on, I don't know very much about Reformed theology, and if you'd asked me something about Calvin's thought a few weeks ago, I'd say, yeah, he's the election guy. He's predestination. Everything's kind of set in stone, and that's the only thing he did. But we're going to set me straight on that here in a second. But as far as Calvin in his life, we know that Lutheran really butted heads with the Catholic Church quite a bit, and you know, he had gone after the church on those indulgences initially, and it really hits him at the financial core. How did Calvin react, how did the Vatican react to Calvin? How were those relationships there?
Well, that's an interesting one. Calvin had had various sorts of interactions with representatives of what we now think of as Roman Catholicism throughout his life, and various sorts of disputations, you know, written sort of exchanges with various people. And to some extent, that's true of Luther as well. In fact, Luther had actual disputes with people like John Eck and, you know, public disputations. Calvin wasn't quite of that ilk, but nevertheless, he had sort of pamphlet wars, if you like, with people who held to the older view. And over time, it became clear that his views were incompatible with the teaching of the Roman Catholic Church. So I suppose as that became clear, the opposition to him from that quarter hardened. So I, there's a story to be told there, slightly different from the story of Luther, in that there's not the kind of decisive event that one often thinks of with Luther. You know, his kind of "Here I stand, I can do no other, so help me God," at which point he's decisively broken from the Roman Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. There's not quite that in the same way for Calvin, but there's this process of coming to a more evangelical view that leads him away from Roman Catholicism and the position that he'd held earlier in his life to a position that was regarded as outside the bounds of that, and means that he ends up being a reformer rather than someone standing within the Roman Catholic Church. But I mean, he was also an inveterate letter writer, and he carried on a very wide correspondence with all sorts of people in Christendom at the time, some of whom might be surprising, you know, heads of state and various different personages that you might not necessarily think were entirely in sympathy with his views. Nevertheless, he was quite happy to write to them and recommend to them the gospel, or to talk to them about various issues that were raised. So he's not sort of someone who's standing in Geneva wagging his hand at those who take a different view. That would be a caricature of things. He has a very interesting and a kind of wide-ranging correspondence with people of all sorts of different views, including people in Lutheranism, people like Philip Melanchthon and so on, who he carried on a congenial relationship with.
Well, this gets to the issue of how his ideas spread. Obviously, they probably spread through his writings and these letters, but it's rather interesting just geographically or spatially about how his ideas land up in certain areas, and this includes the other Reformed writers. I mean, thinking about the folks who are pretty influenced by this, you have the Congregationalists, or known as the Puritans, out there in England, and then also the Presbyterians. How does he get across the channel there to Britain? How do these ideas spread?
Yeah, well, in the case of Scottish Presbyterianism, what happens there has a lot to do with, certainly it's a lot to do with someone like John Knox. And John Knox actually spent some time in Geneva when Calvin was there, and in fact declared reputedly that Geneva was the most perfect city on earth, as far as he was concerned, and took back many of those ideas to Scotland, where there were other leaders of the Reformation in Scotland, but he became a very significant voice in the Scottish Church, and transposed some of the ideas that he'd found in Geneva to a new context. And certainly the way of thinking about the governance of the church, the shape of the church, what the church should look like, is very much indebted to a kind of Geneva model. And I suppose you might think of the Presbyterianism, which is a form of church government that is often associated with Scotland in particular, is really a product of that kind of engagement. I think it's certainly a view that in essence, or in a kind of embryonic form, you can find in the Institutes of the Christian Religion. And that's what Knox and others took over to Scotland. The question of Congregationalism in New England is a little bit more complicated, because there it's not clear to me that there's the same sort of direct relationship with Calvin himself. You have the broadening out of the Reformed tradition and various other people, as I said, who are responsible for its development in various different places, including in England. And the people who, the Puritans, who left England for the New World were a group who were dissatisfied with the pace of reform in the English church and felt like it wasn't going as they thought it ought to, and so ultimately left those shores to try and start a new society on a pattern that they thought was more reformed than were the reforms that they were enjoying in Great Britain at the time. And so Congregationalism was the model of church life that they thought was a better, more New Testament-like pattern than either the Episcopal pattern in England, that is, the rule of the church by bishops, or the Presbyterian pattern that you found in places like the Netherlands and in Scotland. And so Congregationalism was the form of government that many of the earlier settlers in the colonies in New England ended up trying to establish as the state church over there, which it was for a time, but not for very long.
You note in your work that Reformed theology is something that is constantly changing and being reformed. And this is only emphasized by what the Congregationalists are doing. They said, thank you for Presbyterians for carrying the ball this far, but we're going to take it up and move it a little bit forward and change it a little bit. So this is an ongoing process. So how does this theology get picked up and translated throughout the centuries? What are some of the main pivotal moments in the spread and transformation of Reformed theology?
Well, I suppose you've got the events of the Reformation in continental Europe in the 16th century. That obviously starts it all off. But that's happening in various different centers. You've got the Lutheranism of the German states. It wasn't Germany at the time. There was the Holy Roman Empire, which was made up of lots of different semi-independent states. But there's a lot of progress made there for Lutheranism. But some of the states were, some of the what we would now think of as German states were reformed. You've got parts of Switzerland that become reformed, both with Calvin and with Zwingli and other people there, Eichel and Pardius and Bullinger later and people like that and Farrell. Then you have other city-states that get involved in the Reformation along the kind of borders of various parts of the center of Europe, like Strasbourg, where Martin Bucer was a minister. Of course, you've got the kind of unusual thing that's happening in England with Henry VIII deciding he's going to break with the Pope and establish his own church, which has him as the head of the church. And so Anglicanism is established. And that itself, it starts off very much on a kind of reformed model with people like Thomas Cranmer and others. And some of the continental reformers came over to assist the Reformation in England in the early stages. And so there's various interesting things that happen there in England, whilst, of course, north of the border in Scotland, there's something different again happening through this exchange with Geneva. So there's and of course, there's other things happening elsewhere in Europe as well. I'm just giving a sort of overview of one or two things. In the Netherlands, a great reforming movement sweeps across the northern countries, and we see the Dutch Reformed Church being established there that's been so influential in modern Reformed theology. So there's a way in which the Reformation sets the tone for what happens subsequently. And then, in terms of high points, in the post-Reformation period, the immediate century, sort of from the end of the 16th century into the 17th century and beyond into the early 18th century, you have the development of what we might think of as a kind of school theology, where the Reformation had taken place, the politics were calming down, and the churches were sort of getting established in their various locations. But then the question is, well, we want to train ministers to serve all these churches with this new doctrine. How are we going to go about doing that? And what happened was the various schools, academies, and universities that had been established or reformed looked back to medieval period for a model for how to teach their students, and a whole new way of doing theology, which was really an old way of doing theology, grew up where it was kind of very sophisticated and involved a kind of question and answer Socratic method of learning, and a sort of a very rich and deep tradition of theology really takes root in Europe. And at the same time, you've got a kind of pietism that emerges from various aspects of the Protestant tradition. So these two things kind of go side by side into the early Enlightenment period in the 18th century. And then there are some significant changes that happen with the Enlightenment. And you might think of the Enlightenment as a much broader intellectual change that sweeps across Europe that's not reformed, but it nevertheless has implications and impact on the reformed tradition. And as a result of that and the development of things like historical biblical criticism, you have new reformed leaders that are thrown up to address those questions. And someone like Schleiermacher in the early 19th century is someone who makes a big impact in trying to reconceive Christian theology and reform theology in light of these big changes. Whilst, you know, over the other side of the world in New England, you have someone like Jonathan Edwards and the Wesley brothers in England and George Whitfield, who are involved in this more pietistic element with the Great Awakening, this great religious fervor that sort of seizes parts of Europe in the 18th century, and that itself develops a wonderful and rich body of material that's much more to do with kind of a heartfelt religious life. Although Jonathan Edwards is an interesting case in point because he was both a deeply scholarly and sophisticated, intellectually sophisticated individual, as well as someone who was right at the heart of these great religious upheavals in the great awakenings and revivals of the New England period.
I should mention that we are here in December of 2014, and that's the 300th birthday of George Whitefield. So a big happy birthday out there to all you George Whitefield fans.
He was an important figure, and so I think that set the stage for the 19th and then into the 20th century, and you have people in the 19th century trying to shore up various aspects of the Reformed tradition and others taking forward a more liberalizing program. And that goes into the 20th century, and then undoubtedly the dominating influence in terms of the Reformed tradition in the 20th century is Karl Barth, who breaks with his theologically liberal teachers and goes back to thinking about theology as God speaking and God taking the initiative to communicate to us. And writes this huge work of theology called The Church Dogmatics, so big, in fact, that it remained unfinished at his death, but nevertheless a great monument to Reformed theology in the 20th century. And really, in many ways, he ended up rethinking a lot of traditional Reformed categories from the bottom up and coming up with some really remarkable results, which have been very influential to theology up to the present day. There's much more that could be said about this, of course, but those are some of the sort of big highlights, I think.
One question I have is the name Reformed Theology. Did this name come about with Calvin and Zwingli? Were they thinking about, well, we need to give our theology a name at the time, or is it something that emerged later?
That's an interesting question. I think that the way we often think of the term Reformed today is more narrow than it would have had at a certain point in history. We think of it as a particular branch of Protestantism distinct from things like Lutheranism or Anglicanism or, you know, free evangelicals and charismatics and so on. But it's not clear to me that that was always the case. And certainly I think in the early days, the notion of being reformed was, as it were, over and against the existing status quo of Roman Catholicism. So if you were a reformer, then you were part of that new Protestant community. And often you find in the early years that Protestants are kind of conflated or lumped together, even if they represent different streams of Protestantism as we know it today, because things weren't so clear then. You know, so you get people like Cranmer being accused of being Lutheran, even though, of course, he's the architect of the English Reformation in many ways. You get people like Zwingli being compared to other reformers as well. So there's a sense in which the way we look back on these times and think of these clear and distinct religious traditions is to some extent anachronistic, I think. I mean, there's more fluidity at the time, but as things became more distinct over time and positions hardened, I think that you get this name associated with one of the branches of the Reformation tradition and the other taking its name from Lutheranism. And I suppose the third being the Anglican branch, which, of course, is established by Henry VIII saying, we're going to have a Church of England, and that's the end of it.
Well, there might be a very interesting dissertation topic for a budding graduate student out there, the etymology of the name Reformed Theology, because it's not just about the name, but it's about these different thoughts and how they are interpreted over time. So, yeah, any enterprising young graduate students out there, there's your dissertation topic. And that brings us up to current times. You went up through Karl Barth, and he's one of the big 20th century theologians, big thinkers in this name. But now we're in the 21st century, and one of the things that I have noticed in the past decade or so, and this just might be because I'm paying a little bit more attention, but it seems as if there's been a renaissance in Reformed theology. There seems to be a large number of ministers and seminaries and congregations, as well as splinter groups from mainline denominations that are emphasizing their Reformed roots and actually just embedding that name into their theology or into their congregation or denomination. Is this what all the cool pastors are doing nowadays? Where do we stand in the 21st century here with Reformed theology?
I think the resurgence of Reformed theology has been a very interesting phenomenon in many ways. And to some extent, I think what we see is a recovery of certain sorts of doctrinal emphases that are often associated with Reform theology, which might be distinct from the recovery of Reform theology. What I mean by that is something like this. I think that there's a generation that Colin Hanson has called the Young, Restless, and Reformed, which is a loose association of various church groupings, many of which are kind of free evangelical or Baptistic, but nevertheless have latched on to a collection of doctrines that are often associated with the historic Reformed tradition, particularly the so-called five points of Calvinism: the total depravity, unconditional election, limited atonement, irresistible grace, and the perseverance of the saints, which, when you put together, make the acrostic TULIP.
Yes.
And a number of people have, felt that those core notions are really fundamental and they want to hang on to them. Now, that's very much a part of the Reformed tradition, but it's only a part of the Reformed tradition. And so we see ways in which central aspects of Reformed thought and teaching are appropriated by people outside of what historically is kind of confessional Reformed thought. They're not necessarily Presbyterians or Dutch Reformed or whatever it might be. They may well be Baptistic, or they might be Charismatic, or they might be in a non-aligned evangelical church, but nevertheless they hold to these core views. And I think that's a very interesting development. But it does seem to me that development, though very, in my view anyway, very welcome in many respects, is distinct from the sort of confessional Reformed theology, those ecclesiastical bodies which are defined in terms of having a particular confessional basis that unites them together along with a particular sort of church polity and view of things like the sacraments and so on, many of which don't get appropriated by the sort of newer advocates of Reformed theology. So what they're interested in is a certain kind of doctrinal abstraction from the broader Reformed tradition, one that doesn't necessarily involve them in appropriating things like Reformed ecclesiology, that is to say a Reformed doctrine of the church, or a Reformed sacramentology, in other words, a Reformed view of baptism and the Eucharist and things like that. So that's kind of an interesting development, I think. It's not necessarily a bad thing, but it does represent a certain sort of Reformed emphasis, but it's not necessarily identical to, you know, being part of the Reformed confessional tradition.
Is a lot of this playing out because of the way seminary training has been changing over the past few decades, that it seems that used to have a Methodist seminary and a Baptist seminary, yeah, and that's where you went to. But nowadays, when I look at seminaries, they're very multi-confessional. They're all over the map, and people from different traditions are rooming with each other during their graduate training.
Yeah, that may well be part of it, that we live in an age, a kind of postmodern age, where there's a kind of mixing up of all sorts of different traditions and approaches, and there's an openness to be informed by other sorts of traditions and approaches. And that, I think, certainly translates into a number of different seminary contexts. There are still those seminaries that are particularly associated with a given denomination, but even in many of those, you have now students who may come from other traditions who go to that seminary to get their MDiv and go out into the pastorate. I mean, of course, in my own context here at Fuller Theological Seminary in California, we're reputedly the largest multi-denominational seminary in the world, and I have students in my classroom from across the spectrum, including sometimes Roman Catholics as well. So that makes for a very rich experience, I think, and something that's to be welcomed, where you have a kind of broad tent approach to doing theology, people willing to come to a kind of safe place where they can talk and dialogue and interact with and have collegial agreement as well as disagreement with people who represent other different streams of the Christian tradition. And maybe that's part of the reason why we have a sort of resurgent Reformed thought, which is not necessarily associated with the Reformed ecclesiology, doctrine of the church, and confessional tradition of some of the older Reformed churches, if you like. I think also, though, that there's been the rise of a sort of group of ministers, influential ministers in American life, particularly American evangelical life, whose writings have been very influential to a whole generation of young people. And many of those people, although they may not themselves be in Reformed churches, they may be Baptist or Free Evangelical, nevertheless have been deeply influenced by important Reformed thinkers, and therefore they have passed that influence on to the people under their care. So here I'm thinking of someone like, I suppose, John Piper, who's often thought to be one of those individuals, and his penchant for Jonathan Edwards. Or you could have someone like Tim Keller in New York, who's similarly been influential on a whole range of people. He himself, of course, is confessionally Reformed. That's the interesting thing. But he's had a wide influence on people who may not necessarily be confessionally Reformed, but who have taken up the cause of Reformed theology, at least in some way, in their own particular context.
So in terms of the spreading of Reformed theology, and again, it's spreading all over the place in a lot of different forms. You say confessional form, but also people just picking up the name and slapping it on their theology. This can lead to different interpretations and popular misconceptions, and this is in part what your book does. And you have these two terms in your book that I really like. You talk about Reformed uninformed and Reformed misinformed. I consider myself to be part of both of those groups. Give us some of what you think are some of the popular misconceptions about Calvinism or Reformed theology, I should say, specifically.
Well, I think one of the first places to start is with this notion of tulip Calvinism, you know, the total depravity, unconditional election, limited atonement, irresistible grace, perseverance of the saints.
Oh, I'm going to stop you there. I want you to go through that a little bit slower.
Yeah.
Because it's very interesting. When you're saying that, it sounds like you've memorized it almost like part of the liturgy at,
right.
You know, churches that, okay, this is the, you know, time in the service that I do this.
Right.
So slow down, because I had not heard of tulip until I read your book. So what is tulip again?
So tulip is supposed to be the kind of boiled down version of the teachings of the Synod of Dort, which is one of the most important Reformed councils, I suppose, that you might say, which came together to define Reformed theology over and against what was regarded as the mistaken views of early Arminian theology, those who followed the teaching of Jacob Arminius, who was himself a Reformed professor at Leiden University in the Netherlands. And often it's been thought that the Synod of Dort taught these 5 points of Calvinism. So they are the idea that we're totally depraved, which is roughly this notion that we have this moral corruption as a result of the fall and have original sin, and that affects every part of who we are. It doesn't mean that every action is totally depraved, but it does mean that we have this bias towards sin and have this moral corruption, which means that we will inevitably sin. And then there's unconditional election, and that's the notion that God ordains the salvation of some number of human beings independent of anything he foresees about how they're going to live their lives. That's what's unconditional. And this is based on passages like Romans 8:28-30 in the New Testament, or Ephesians 1, where we're told that God chooses us and elects us according to his good pleasure and will. So the idea is that it's just simply by his will and good pleasure that he makes the decision to save some people. And that's the unconditional election bit. Limited atonement may be a bit of a misnomer. The idea here is that in God's intention and purposes to save those whom he's chosen, he ensures that the work of Christ is accomplished for those people and applied to those people and those people alone, so that that Christ dies for, as it were, the elect, and accomplishes salvation for the elect. So the atonement, in terms of its scope, is limited to the salvation of the elect. Irresistible grace is this idea that, in terms of our coming to salvation, it's entirely a work of God's grace and entirely a work of the Holy Spirit. And when the Holy Spirit works secretly in our hearts to renew our lives and to awaken us to faith, is irresistible. If he desires to bring us to salvation, it's something that will inevitably happen through this special and secret work of God, and it's entirely a work of God. And that's linked to the claim, the last claim, the perseverance of the saints, which is the P bit of Tulip. And there the idea is that if you are saved, then you will, if you're a member of this elect that God has ordained will be saved, then you will persevere in that salvation to the end. Sometimes that's captured by the phrase, once saved, always saved. In other words, you can't lose your salvation if you truly are a member of God's invisible church, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
So those are some of the central claims. And I think, as I said earlier, there's a lot to be said for these 5 points of Calvinism. They do represent something important in the Reformed tradition, there's no doubt about it. But I suppose one of the things I'm trying to do in the book is to say that the Reformed tradition is broader than the 5 points of Calvinism, and indeed there are some Reformed theologians who haven't necessarily subscribed to all five of those points, but would certainly be Reformed theologians, part of that confessional tradition that's identifiable as Reformed, and I try and discuss some of those issues in the book. In particular, I zero in on the work of Bishop John Davenant, who was an English, an Anglican bishop and professor who was headed up the British delegation to go to the Synod of Dort, so the very place where we get the 5 points of Calvinism, and signed up to the Synod of Dort for the British delegation. But nevertheless, in his writings, it's clear that he does not think that the atonement is limited in the way that the 5 points of Calvinism would suggest. He thinks that Christ's work is sufficient for all, but actually efficient or effectual only for the elect. And he talks about the way in which Christ works its atonement for all, but the gift of faith is only given to the elect.
Hmm.
He talks about this as being a conditional ordained sufficiency. So there's a sense in which, yes, Christ does die for all, and we see that in the New Testament. We read John 3:16, for God so loved the world, he gave his only begotten Son. So Davenant thinks those sorts of passages say that God sends his Son to die for the world. So his work must be sufficient for everybody. But it can only be effectual for those whom God chooses to give faith to, that is, the elect. And so there's this distinction between the atonement being universal, but in some sense only being efficacious for the elect. And that distinction, the sufficiency-efficiency distinction, as it's sometimes called, which is characteristic of this broader account of Christ's work in the atonement, is much older than the Reformation. It goes way back into medieval theology, and you can find it in important medieval figures like Peter Lombard, whose work called The Sentences became the kind of textbook of medieval universities. So, in a sense, someone like John Davenant is aligning himself with a very old tradition of thinking about the work of Christ and doesn't seem to have any qualms about holding that view and signing up to the canons of the Synod of Dort. Well, my question as I was thinking about this was, well, how can this be the case? And it seems to me, upon reading issues around this topic and reading some of the historical work that I mentioned earlier, that the Synod of Dort doesn't necessarily commit you to a doctrine of limited atonement as some people seem to think it does. So there's a kind of conceptual porousness, you might say, to what Davenant signed up to, which allowed him to hold on to his own views whilst in good faith signing up to the standard of the Synod. And I think that's a kind of case study of precisely the sort of richness and variegated nature of the Reformed tradition that I'm trying to impress upon readers in the book, that there's something broader than what we often think of as being Reformed theology. And the people that I'm talking about here aren't sort of liminal figures, people on the edges who it's not clear whether they're Reformed or not, but people who are very much front and center in the Reformed tradition, even if we're not so familiar with them today. I imagine most people have never heard of John Davenant. But he was an important leader in the Reformed Church, important enough for King James to send him to lead the delegation to this vital continental synod. So I think that's really interesting, that when we look at the actual history and we see what it has to teach us, it turns out the things are rather different from perhaps the textbook tradition that some of us have been brought up on, where we associate Calvinism with the 5 points, and if you are a Calvinist and you're a five-pointer, well, it may well be that that's not necessarily the case. That's not the whole story, and that the tradition itself is broader than the report that's often given of it.
Yeah, I'm totally counting on that sufficiency for all thing, because I don't think I'm part of the elect. So, you know, it's good to hear that they're broadening out on that a little bit, and so that's encouraging there. There's a lot of stuff that is going on here, and we won't be able to have time to cover everything in your book, and I want people to go and pick up your book, because it's written very well, and for somebody like me who's can't follow all those esoteric terms in theology, you explain a great deal of this quite well. One of the issues that comes up with me, and this is the stereotypical Calvinist doctrine of being elected. You have a chapter in your book that is entitled Libertarian Calvinism. Yeah. And for our listeners who read Ayn Rand or who want to legalize pot or get big government off our backs, that sounds like it's going to be the most appealing portion of the book for you. But that isn't quite it. What is going on with this Libertarian Calvinism, and how does this wrestle with this whole issue of free will and determinism stuff that swirls around Calvinism?
Well, this is an interesting one. I mean, I think often because of the doctrine of God predestining things that's associated with the Reformed tradition, and Calvin in particular, people have a popular idea of the Reformed tradition, according to which to be Reformed is to believe that God determines all that comes to pass. And again, I do think that there are many Reformed historically and today, well, certainly today anyway, whose views would be captured by that notion. You know, God determines all that comes to pass. And then the idea would be that we are free, but our freedom must be consistent with God ordaining all that comes to pass. So freedom turns out to be something like choosing according to what you desire. You know, you can choose what you want, what you most desire, and that be an outcome that's determined in advance. If that's what freedom is, then those two things can be consistent. I can be free and God can determine all things. Now, that sort of view has a kind of vogue in much Reformed theology, but does it represent the whole of the tradition? And this is the question that I had as I started looking into this. And it's not clear to me that it does represent the whole tradition, or at least it's not clear to me that one has to hold to that exact view in order to be Reformed. And the more I looked into it, the more it seemed to me that there are there's a breadth perhaps there as well. So in older Reformed theology, there was talk of the idea that we have the so-called bondage of the will, that our human will is bound over to sin. This has to do with moral corruption that we were talking about earlier. So that we can't ever will our own salvation because we're incapable of doing so. But it's not clear that this notion of the bondage of the will prevents me from making choices in all sorts of mundane matters where I have a freedom that includes some kind of alternative at the moment of choice. Well, that's interesting and curious, because that doesn't seem to fit neatly into this notion that God determines everything that happens and my freedom has to be consistent with that. At least it looks like there's some a way of thinking about that doesn't require that much stronger deterministic view. And that's the view that I tried to explore in this chapter. And the view would be something like this, that there may well be many mundane choices that we make, you know, choices to do with anything from what I eat for breakfast in the morning to, you know, who I marry, perhaps. So it's not necessarily weightless choices. There might be important choices that I make, but they may be choices that I have a real freedom in making, and there may be an alternative at the moment I make that choice that I could have gone for but don't. Nevertheless, there's another sphere, if you like, of choices which are forever beyond me now because of being in a state of sin. And so if that's the case, then perhaps the way to think of it is that there are certain choices that are beyond our reach as a consequence of being fallen human beings, that we can't, for example, choose our own salvation because of being in bondage to sin. That has to be entirely a work of divine grace, so that there's choices that I have which I do have much more control of, you know, whether to have one thing or another for breakfast, whether to marry this girl or that girl. And there are other choices that I'm just incapable of making because I'm in a state of sin, and that God has to step in and deal with for me. For example, in the matter of salvation. In the book, I use this example of the Green Lantern, who's a comic book character in the DC universe, and Hal Jordan, who's one of the Green Lantern Corps. He's a normal human being until he puts on this power ring that gives him the power to transform things according to his will, and this ring then is enabled him to do all sorts of things. And I say that maybe our state in bondage to sin is a bit like the Green Lantern, maybe like Hal Jordan. We have certain things that we can will, mundane choices, like Hal Jordan can choose what he has for breakfast and which girl he dates and things like that. But there are certain things that Hal can't will, just as Hal Jordan, like he can't will to be able to fly around the world or lift great weights or whatever it might be. But once he's got the power ring on, he's able to do those things. And in a sense, that's a bit like us being worked upon by the power of the Holy Spirit and God graciously enabling us to make certain choices once we're saved, once we're in a state of grace. Mm-hmm. But like Hal Jordan, without that state of grace, without that powering on in the case of salvation, without the internal working of the Holy Spirit, which is entirely nothing to do with us, but everything to do with God, just like Hal Jordan's ring has nothing to do with him, but it's bestowed upon him. Without that, we're incapable of making the right sorts of choices.
I have to thank you for that, by the way, too. And I wish more theologians would use comic book references, because I'd be able to figure this stuff out. I mean, this stuff, this free will stuff, I always have people explain this to me, and they go through it, and I, at the time, nod my head, and I say, okay, I think I got it. And then a week later, I try to recast it differently in my head to make sure that I've understood it, and I can never do that. So you've helped to clear it up. But on the other hand, I think about a week from now, I'm going to forget it again. So, But the comic book reference is very useful doing that. And if I can remember Green Lantern and Hal Jordan, I need that power ring to expand my range of freedom. I think that's that'd be pretty good. One of the other themes in your book, too, is universalism. So you had libertarianism and then universalism. Cover what that all means here.
Yeah, so I mean, I think this much of the book really is about the scope of salvation, which I suppose is one of the most important issues in Christianity. You know, who is saved? How can I be saved? I mean, these are really fundamental existential questions that we all ask ourselves at some time or other. And really, many of the questions of the book are trying to address that set of issues from within the Reformed tradition. Universalism is just the view that ultimately all people will be saved, so that no one will be no one will go to perdition or be punished forever in hell. And ultimately, all people will be united to God in Christ. And there are various sorts of people who've advocated one or other version of universalism in the Christian tradition, and there are various brands of universalism. It's often been thought, though, that if you're in the Reformed tradition, then you've got a good bulwark against universalism because you believe in a doctrine of election, where God elects some to salvation and passes over others, and they end up in perdition. So, you know, that's a good reason for thinking that Calvinism is a sort of a strong defense against universalism, and we don't want to be universalists. Well, it's not clear to me that that's the case. I say something like this. Well, okay, you might think there's a biblical argument for thinking God saves only some of the human race, not all of the human race. But when you look at the, the sort of logic of the Reformed position, independent of those biblical arguments, well, there's no good reason for thinking that it must be the case that salvation is restricted to some fraction of the human race. In fact, if God has the power to save, what's there to stop him from saving everybody? It looks like if the Reformed view is true, then he has the power to save everybody. There's no obstacle to him doing so. So then the question is why God only saves some number less than the total number of human beings. And in the book I try to set up an argument for the conclusion that God both could save everybody, given the Reformed scheme of things, and indeed he should save everybody, given the Reformed scheme of things, because it's objectively morally better that all people be saved than that some people be saved and other people aren't saved. And, of course, I'm not the only person to have said this. In the 19th century, B.B. Warfield, a great Reformed theologian, made the point that Reformed thought sort of presses in the direction of universalism, and what stops it going in that direction is the biblical argument, which says that, well, at least as is often understood, says that God saves some but not all. In the book, I set up this argument, and then I try to provide reasons for resisting it. And one reason that I end up alighting upon is this idea that God creates in such a way that he has to display the panoply of his attributes in that which he's created, so that his justice as well as his mercy must be displayed in the created order, in order that his name is vindicated and his name is glorified. Well, if that's true, and that seems to be a sort of assumption of many people in the Reformed tradition, well, it would be then make sense for God to bring it about that not everyone is saved, but some people are justly punished for their sin in order to show the justice of God, whilst on the other hand his mercy is extended to the rest of humanity. And it may well be, as some Reformed theologians have speculated, that the number of those who is saved will far outweigh the tiny fraction of humanity that ends up in perdition. So those are some of the issues there in terms of universalism. I've already touched upon universal atonement, which is also something I discuss in the book, but that's slightly different. There the idea isn't necessarily that all people are saved, which is universalism, but rather that Christ's work on the cross in particular is such that it's sufficient for the salvation of all people, so that we can say that Christ dies for the world, although in fact God gives the gift of faith only to those who are elect, whatever number that is. Mm-hmm. So there are different ways in which universalism is used in Christian theology and in the Reformed tradition, and in the book what I try to do is explore several different ways in which that's used, and some of the options that there are out there, that this great richness that comes from the Reformed tradition is able to provide us with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I am counting on those theologians who think that more people are going to be saved than are not. So I got to bet on that one.
I like that too.
I do too. Sounds good. This is really fascinating, and your book does an excellent job of addressing these themes, which are very complicated theological themes, and you do much more than what we've talked about here in the hour that we've had. But I want to leave you off with one question. This is a question I always have for theologians. Everything that we've been talking about here is really good for theologians to be debating at Fuller or Princeton Theological Seminary, but the average person on the pews on Sunday, they might maybe affiliate with some particular denomination or have some kind of mild understanding of what it means to be Reformed versus Pentecostal versus Congregational or etc. But how much of these theological discussions that you've crafted throughout your career really matter to the typical layperson? Or are we just debating the numbers of angels on that can dance on the head of a pin? How does this translate to the average laity out there?
That's a really good question. I mean, first of all, I would say some questions are worth pursuing just as an end in themselves, because it's worth knowing. There's an important virtue in knowing more, I think. And so you might say that some of these issues are issues that are, in some sense, an end in themselves. Knowing more about God, knowing about his ways is a good thing, irrespective of any practical application. But I do think the practical application is really important, and it's a question in my situation which I get asked all the time, because, of course, a lot of the time I'm talking to people who are training to be pastors, and they want to know, what's the point of learning theology? What's the point of knowing about a lot of these apparently arcane things that we're talking about here? And my view has always been that actually plumbing these theological depths can have very practical applications. Often it's a kind of trickle-down effect. But think of it like this. You're in a pastoral situation. You're having to deal with all sorts of difficulties in a given week, let alone on a Sunday morning. And you're being asked all sorts of difficult questions by different people on different occasions. How are you going to face those people with a consistent set of answers if you don't have a theological framework that helps you to do so? I mean, in other words, if you're doing stuff off the cuff and saying one thing to one person and another thing to another person, you may end up in a bit of a bind where you're saying different things to different people on different occasions that may not add up to one whole. Even worse, you may end up thinking, I don't really know what to say to this person. I don't have sufficient theological depth of field to really have something helpful to say in this pastorally fraught situation. So I think that theology is vital for us in those situations. It would be a bit like saying to a physician, well, you can just look at some person's symptoms and give them some answer to their problems, as opposed to someone who's got a training in medical science and therefore, when they are presented with certain symptoms, can reflect on the kind of framework of medical knowledge that they've imbibed and say, okay, these symptoms seem to be this kind of problem. Now, I think something similar is happening with pastors in churches, that to have a theological framework with which to work is vital if you're going to do the job properly and effectively. In the case of the particular issues I talk about here, which some of which do seem sort of a bit arcane, I do think that figuring these things out has important implications for those sorts of pastoral applications. For example, people are always asking pastors, can I be saved? Can the people I know be saved? Can you exclude yourself from salvation? Did Christ really come to save everybody? Or does he only come to save good people? You know, all those sorts of questions which people are asking all the time and really do touch a nerve, I think, that many people have. These are questions that I'm addressing in the book. You know, does Christ's work extend to everyone? Can we really say that Christ so loved the world that he gave his life for it? Or is it the case that he only loves a certain number of people and dies for them instead? Though they may seem to be arcane matters, are, I think, issues that when we boil it down to its essence, are issues that really affect us in a vital way. And I think, in particular, affect those in pastoral contexts in a vital way. And so I hope that in reflecting upon some of these deep matters, it might help us, all of us, not just those who are pastors, to figure out some of these difficult matters, or at least to have more informed views, so that when we're faced with these difficult matters, we have something helpful and useful, as well as hopefully something true to say to those people who are struggling in sometimes very difficult situations.
That might be the best answer that I have ever heard to that question. And it's one that really resonates with me as a professor who deals with a lot of esoteric and arcane jargon and concepts and theories all the time as well. But having that underlying framework to help organize your other thoughts, which allows you to talk to other people in consistent ways, is a very, very good and strong observation. And I want to thank you for mentioning that, because, again, it's one of the best answers I've ever heard to that. My guest today has been Oliver Crisp, and his latest book is Deviant Calvinism, Broadening Reformed Theology, very worth your time and reading. Oliver, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.